Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Midnight Mass podcast. It's me, your old ghoul friend, Peaches Christ, and I'm here with my dear friend, the co-host that you love so much, the one, the only, it's Michael Verratti.
Well, hello, hello, Peaches. As we have proven on this podcast, we both love going to the movies, but sometimes it can be hell.
Even more than that, we love movies about going to the movies. So yes. Much so that I actually made one. But it is a genre that you and I both adore. And perhaps one of the most influential and inspiring films that I've ever seen about this genre. This is a subgenre, specifically movies about going to the movies.
Or movie medium, basically. Yeah.
Which includes movies like Popcorn, Matinee, starring John Goodman. There's tons of them, but this film might be my favorite. The listeners are salivating, just waiting. They're just drooling, waiting for you to announce what film we're tackling this week.
Yeah, drooling pussy green puddles on the floor.
They are, out of their fangs.
If that is not enough of an indicator, we are talking about 1985's Demons, directed by Lamberto Bava, famously produced by Dario Argento, with a screenplay by Argento, Bava, Dardano Sacchetti, Franco Farini, and starring Urbano Barberini, Natasha Hovey, Giretta Dredda, Michele Suave, Bobby Rhodes, and lots of goo and gore.
Wow, Michael, you are definitely the right Italian to be pronouncing all of those different names. Good job.
Oh, thank you. I mean, meanwhile, someone in Italy is like, he messed it up, you know?
Yeah. Probably Lucio Felci is listening and is angry.
First off, I hope somewhere there is a drag king named Lucio Felci. That would be amazing.
Me too. That would be a faux king. We used to do this back in the day at the nightclubs. We would have faux nights where, you know, some of us drag queens would dress as drag kings for the night.
Did you have an alternate king name?
I think one night I was Sean Delier. Dumb. It's not even good. I need to do a new character, Lucio Felci. That's going to be me. Okay. Anyway, we're not here to talk about the director.
We're here to talk about Lamberto Bava, who is, of course, the son of the legendary Italian horror filmmaker Mario Bava, but a famous filmmaker in his own right. Not only did he make Demons, he made gialli such as A Blade in the Dark and Delirium, lots of great horror projects such as Graveyard Disturbance or A Dinner with a Vampire, and this like sprawling fantasy epic for Italian television called Fantaghiro. I'm a big fan of Lamberto Bava. I think that his legacy is just as strong as his father's and it surpasses it in different ways.
I'm glad that you brought up the television of it all because I'm not as familiar with his television work. However, I went and started looking at clips from things like The Ogre, Graveyard Disturbance, Dinner with a Vampire, just because I didn't know that he had done all that television. But if you do a cursory look at his Wikipedia page, you'll see that he has a bunch of television credits and also some really fun and interesting AD credits, which, you know, introduced me to titles I wasn't aware of. So Lamberto Bava, this is a love fest to you. Admittedly, I think Michael and I fall prey to this as well. When talking about Demons, it's hard not to let the producer of this film sort of overshadow who gets the credit for the movie in many ways because it's one of those titans of filmmaking. The movie was produced by Dario Argento. And of course, I think we can all agree that Dario's hand is seen in the film, but this is not an Argento movie. This is a Bava movie. This is Lamberto's movie. And Dario Argento, I think, had that ability to take a filmmaker like Lamberto Bava and elevate them, you know, because that name, the Argento name, got more eyes on this film than would otherwise. It's the Steven Spielberg to Toby Hooper of it all, right? You've got, you know, Spielberg producing Poltergeist, and that's partly what made it such a massive hit. Now, I think in the case of Poltergeist, Spielberg actually really did overshadow Hooper to the degree that people just refused to give Toby Hooper the credit that he deserved for directing an incredible movie.
Which is a shame because a lot of folks have gone on the record to say that Hooper did in fact direct the movie. It is a matter, of course, that he did.
Including the entire cast. You know, it's like, sorry, but when Joe Beth Williams comes out and says, Toby directed this, who are you going to listen to? The female lead who was asked to roll around ceilings and dive into pools with actual corpses? What does she have to lose? And Spielberg himself has come out to say Toby directed it.
But I think it's relevant to the conversation about demons for all the reasons that you said, because we're here to celebrate Lamberto Bava. We want to give Lamberto Bava his propers. But as you'll notice, when we get into our interviews, both of our interviews do end up veering into some Argento territory because the shadow of Argento is long with regards to this movie. And I think with regards to this movie's marketing. I mean, we sitting here as horror film fans know the power of Lamberto Bava and are celebrating the artistry of Lamberto Bava. But it is hard to deny that even in the marketing of demons, which they themselves submitted to. It's like Argento's name is at the top of that poster. Argento's name leads in a lot of the PR. So what happens is it creates this sort of collective memory of Argento, sometimes in a way that replaces Bava in the conversation about demons. And I think that's really interesting to talk about because it's not something that's relegated to this era. I mean, Demons and Poltergeist both came out in the 80s, but I think of something like V for Vendetta, which famously was produced by the Wachowskis, but was not directed by them. But when you talk about that movie, people often veer towards the Wachowskis, you know?
The other similarity is that Argento and Spielberg both co-authored these films, right? Like they came up with, well, we don't know how much. I mean, you know, we don't know, but they're both given credits for either story development or writing directly, script writing. So that all is to say that Lamberto Bava, child of Mario Bava, is a very talented filmmaker. And Demons has, I think, a uniqueness to it that you and I both just respond to. I think it's a standalone genius film. I know that it has a sequel, and we're going to get into that. And Patreon subscribers are going to get a deeper dive in a Midnight Mini Mass, which you're going to find out about as you listen to the episode. But we're going to do a Demons 2 Midnight Mini Mass exclusive for our Patreon listeners. But Demons is, honestly, Michael, it's one of my favorite horror movies ever made. And as you know, for me to say that says a lot. Now, it's true. I have a lot of favorite horror movies, but it would be in a top 10. I mean, top 10. And I love hundreds, if not thousands, of horror movies.
No, it's true you do. And I think that part of the appeal of this movie is the fact that it is such a brilliant fusion of so many great things at once. Mm-hmm. You have that high art of Italian horror, but it's landing smack dab in the middle of the 80s where we're like hitting the stride of the slasher film in the States and kind of that over the top gore. And then the new wave sheen, the big music, the big hair, the big everything. It's Italian art meets the decade of excess thrown together at a movie theater. And at this time where people are going to the movies to worship at the altar of gore films, to set a gore film at the theater during the era when it's at its zenith, of course it's going to be awesome, especially when helmed by an awesome filmmaker. And I think it's just kind of that perfect stew, that perfect Italian wedding soup, if you will, of all of the elements, of all of the things that make it happen.
Something to point out when thinking about this film is, as much as I would love to double feature it, maybe with another movie that came out in 1985, that to me represents a beautiful pairing of style and music and zombies and monsters, which is Return of the Living Dead. And if you think about the fact that both these films came out in 1985, and what a great evening at the movies it would make to do a double feature, and I'm sure it's been done, although I've never been invited to this double feature, but Return of the Living Dead with Demons, Italian chef's kiss, it's just perfection.
Buonissimo. I think that what's great about that double feature is how in concert they are with each other. There seems to be a conversation between the films, and it's not a matter of one of them influencing the other, because as you know, movies are often in production for a long time before they ever reach the theater. So if anything, these movies were being made at the same time, likely, but not probably aware of one another as they're being being made.
We know that because they both came out in 1985. There's no way that a movie can come out in 1985 and then someone else goes, oh my God, I want to do that. And then releases another movie in 1985 that, you know, it doesn't, that's not how it works.
No, but I think there's just such a great cultural conversation and there's so much synergy between them. The idea that there is a punk rock thread between them. There is a use of modern music that was considered alt modern music at the time that has become in some ways a little more mainstream.
Funnily, Demons, I think, actually leans into a more of a popular soundtrack, which you would think it'd be the other way around. I mean, Return of the Living Dead has actually got some of the best alt punk new wave music going. Demons actually is classic 80s. I mean, they've got Motley Crue at that time and Billy Idol at that time were as big as you get in the music industry. But God, are they quintessentially 80s, you know, and it is the soundtrack of that era. But yeah, I love this movie so much. Now, you are actually friends with one of the stars of the film. And as someone who knows Jaretta, have you gotten any nuggets about the making of this movie? Just before the listeners ask, why didn't you get her to be on the show? We're actually saving her for another episode where we talk to her about one of her favorite movies.
I've had the good pleasure of knowing Jaretta for, I think, over a decade now. We met thanks to the convention circuit, and she is truly lovely, and she has a lot to say about her time making films in Italy with many directors. She worked with Fulci, she worked with Argento and Bava and Bruno Mattei, and it's sort of like kind of the greatest hits of Italian horror directors that she had the opportunity to work with. It's been a long time since she and I sat and talked about Demons, so I don't know that I remember any particular bon mots with clarity that I would say without probably getting wrong, but I know that she really embraces this role, and I know that she really loves this role. And I see her to this day on social media posting photos of the behind the scenes and memories of the movie, and it's just such a cool character. I mean, she is the demon that kickstarts the movie. She gets that whole gross transformation, and she's so wonderful. And in that becomes one of the emblematic images of 80s horror, not just Italian 80s horror, but 80s horror.
She is an icon. She's so great. They named her twice. She is Jaretta Jaretta. And to me, she is a star. And when I saw this movie, you know, as a young person devouring horror movies, and also recognizing later in life how special Jaretta Jaretta is as far as the power of seeing a beautiful, cool, stylish Black woman in an 80s horror movie get to be, you know, a fierce monster and not the first victim, as the trope goes, was crazy influential for me, because not only did I love this movie, but I also just loved the style of it. I loved her power. I loved her monstrosity. I loved her fierceness. Jaretta Jaretta in Demons is fierce, and she's just wonderful. I'm jealous that you're friends with her.
Well, she's lovely, and I can't wait to introduce you to her, and we will definitely find the film that she wants to discuss with us. In the meantime, we're discussing the movie that is one of her calling cards.
We have incredible guests today, and the first one you've introduced me to, I would venture to say, might be one of the biggest Demons fans I've ever met.
Yes, this person is a filmmaker who I had the opportunity to not only befriend, but executive produce his motion picture, The Latent Image. And as we worked together and got to know each other, I found out how very influenced he was by the world of Italian horror. And knowing that, seeing how much he celebrates it in his own work and life, made him the perfect person to call for this episode. It's Alex Birrell, and we're talking to him about Demons right now. Welcome back, listeners. Though he hails from the UK, I happen to know our next guest is obsessed with and inspired by the masters of Italian horror, which is why I knew he was the perfect person to call for today's discussion. He is the acclaimed filmmaker of such shorts as Suspicions, Blackout, and 2019's The Latent Image, as well as the 2010 feature film Brain Cell and a segment of the horror anthology Sleepaway Slasher. Most recently, this individual returned to the world of The Latent Image, expanding the story into an all-new, critically acclaimed feature film of the same name that has played numerous festivals in such prestigious venues as Los Angeles's Music Hall Theater and London's Prince Charles Cinema. What's more, I'm proud to say I got to be part of The Latent Image feature film's journey as one of the film's executive producers, and I was able to watch firsthand this person's drive to create bold, new queer horror. He's a director, writer, producer, colleague, and friend. Please welcome Alexander McGregor Birrell. Alex, welcome to the show.
Yay.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you for the intro, and hello to Peaches, and I'm really happy to be here. It's a film that I feel like I could talk about for a long time.
Well, I knew that, and I know that through our many conversations over the years, how drawn you are to the works of Italian horror, and when we were plotting to do Demons, I reached out to you and asked if you had thoughts on this, and you said absolutely. So let's start there. What's your relationship with this film particularly? When did you first see it? Where does it rank in the world of Italian horror for you? All of the above, none of the above, whatever you want to start with.
Well, I go back to VHS days with this film, and I can't put a precise year on it, but I know I was 8. So that narrows it down a little bit to sort of 1989, 1990. And I only know that because it was involved in me getting it as a birthday present, as a tape that I'd looked at on the shelves for a long time and had seen clips of in a documentary, which really got me excited to see it. Years later, it turned out they were actually clips that were taken from the Michele Soavi, Dario Argento's World of Horror documentary, but somehow they'd been taken out and put in this new thing. And it was that footage that everyone who's seen the documentary will remember, where you have clips in the film and then it cuts to all the fake teeth they made for the demons with the music playing over, and you sort of see the animatronic demon head get deconstructed, and you see them operate the remote control and everything. And at that time, it was kind of my gateway into Italian horror, in the sense that I had seen Suspiria, but only Suspiria. I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen in the world. And I became obsessed with trying to track down every single thing that this guy Dario Argento was ever involved in. And it just so happened that there would be this video case with the beautiful Enzo Schotti poster, you know, with the Bobby Rhodes demon kind of coming over the staircase with the blue light. And of course, I didn't then, as a lot of people, wasn't looking at a Lamberto Bava film. I was looking at the massive yellow Dario Argento Presents, which got me to then want the tape.
Everything you just described, I relate to. And Dario Argento was my reason for seeing Demons, but of course it opened up the world of Bava. That being said, in the bigger world of Italian horror, this might sound like sacrilege, but of all of these incredible filmmakers, and not even to talk about the filmmakers necessarily, Bava versus Argento or any of that, but Demons is my favorite all-time Italian horror movie. I know that people are going, what about Suspiria or, you know, opera or whatever? But it's Demons for me. And Demons has a special place in my heart that's been inspiring forever. And anyone who knows me and knows what I love knows that this movie is incredibly important. And one of the things that I love about it is that I love movies that take place in cinemas. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, were you, like me, someone who was obsessed with going to the movies in that way, that there's a special mystique around this, you know, this movie, because these people are invited to a magical movie experience? You know, what is it about Demons that you love so much?
Well, I mean, you've touched on a perfect thing there with the cinema experience, because almost every weekend when I was a kid, it felt like every weekend, with my mom and maybe a friend from school and their mom, we'd always go to the cinema. I'm also old enough to remember, at least in terms of England and Liverpool, when cinemas weren't yet multiplexes, they were kind of a bit sleazy and skeezy. And I remember things like being taken to see reruns of Disney movies. And I literally can see it now, because I was sort of so obsessed with like the popular culture of the time and looking around, you know, like there'd be the poster of Betty Blue in the hallway of the cinema where you'd just gone to see like a re-release of Bambi. And so there was this like great cross mix in terms of everything that was available at the time. And you were also, you know, you weren't going into this place with like plush carpet or anything. You were going up the back stairs of a not very nice car park and going into this one screen cinema with uncomfortable seats. And there was always kind of a very much an excitement, but there's also kind of a slight fear element, you know, when the lights go down and what's going to happen. And I actually remember around the time I would have seen Demons was my first kind of experience. There was a big sort of 14 screen place that opened very close to the suburb of the city where I was from. And so that was kind of like my first experience of what I kind of think of as being like American cinema going, you know, where there'd be like freshly popped popcorn and there'd be a themed carpet and there'd be, you know, multiple movies playing across multiple screens. But that was kind of all new. So kind of the rundown looks like it's about to close down Art Deco-y sort of cinema that they have in Berlin in Demons is very much the type of thing that we had here. And they still all exist, and they've all been converted into supermarkets and bingo halls and things. But all those buildings that are so much cinemas, they're kind of still there, you know? So I always get a little sense of when I go past some of them now, when I'm back in Liverpool, I'll think like, well, I wish someone had made that back into a cinema. And also you could really just remake Demons there right this second.
Well, isn't it true of so many of those great movie palaces or even the small single screen theaters that of yesteryear? I know it's the same in San Francisco, but here in LA, if you drive through downtown Los Angeles, the marquees are still there. But then when you look at the building, it's an Urban Outfitters or, you know, like an Apple store or something.
Or even more depressing, some bizarre church that like seems like it's you're going to go in there and people will never be heard or seen from again. And it's like some pronouncement. But, you know, like Back to the Future where the I can't remember. It was like a cinema that then becomes a porn cinema next to a preacher's place in Back to the Future. It's kind of like,
right.
Yeah.
One thing I want to talk about is the Lamberto Bava and Argento of it all. I think that both of you spoke to the draw of Dario Argento. I think that's probably universally true for people, especially outside of Italy, who were discovering this movie. Argento's name was put in big font over the title. And so a lot of people are brought into this movie because of Argento, but as we all know, it's not an Argento movie in the sense that he didn't direct it, Lamberto Bava did. And Bava, by this point, already has a body of work. And I think that we know that Argento contributed to the screenplay, so there are elements of Argento here. But what is it about this movie that makes it a Bava film and not an Argento film?
There's a sense of humor that is very Bava, I think, that he sort of gets from his father and is very much within his films. Obviously, the whole self-reflexive element, I mean, it's there right from Blade in the Dark that he'd only just done a few years earlier. Then he carries on doing that a lot. Like you've got some of the TV movies, which were released in the UK, actually, as direct to VHS feature films. So I kind of grew up after Demons, like getting a lot of them. Films like what was released here is Demons 3, The Ogre, The House of the Ogre, where you got a horror novelist. Then he did one called Prince of Terror about a horror film director. I lived in Italy for a while in the early 2000s, and there was a new film of his that came out called The Torturer, which was very much in that kind of Saw era. It was like one of the first Italian digital video films at the time. And that's about, there's a film director and there's a fan who's written like a thesis about his horror films. And she's the other main character. So I just think that sort of self-reflexive thing, that kind of meta cinema is something that he's done from the very beginning, probably because his entire life has been cinema. And his father was in the cinema, his grandfather was in the cinema. So for him, it's not meta. I mean, it's just his life, really.
That makes total sense. The whole thing about a movie within a movie and the movie that they're watching is what creates the horror that is happening all around them, thanks to Nostradamus, of course. I'm wondering if with our favorite horror movies, especially something as fun as Demons, and I think that's part of what gives it that sort of special quality, at least for me, it's just fucking fun in a way that some of the Italian horror movies aren't. It's intentionally fun. And I'm wondering, do you have a favorite kill or gore moment or just any moment? I mean, I know I have one that's indelibly marked, but I want to ask you first.
I'd say the transformation more than a kill. The second transformation, when she's on the stage, she just bursts through the screen, Carmen, and she slowly transforms into the demon while they're all watching, you know. And you've had that great dialogue before about when she's banging on the screen and there's all the sound and she's saying those screams sound real and he's saying, come on, it's only the Dolby and, you know, all stuff like that. That's just really made it such a special experience. And then oddly enough, my favorite scene in the whole movie, though, it's not even like a big set piece, because I love, you know, riding around the cinema, killing the zombies with the machete and everything. But for me, it was when they all run to the doors of the cinema and you have that great montage and they're pulling all the doors off and they're all walled in.
Yeah.
That's my favorite scene in the whole film.
I have to interject here before Michael jumps in and let you know that you and I have the same favorite moment. The transformation, the bursting through the screen, that whole sequence. In fact, it was so inspiring to me that in the original screenplay for my film, All About Evil, I had basically stolen that whole thing. And I don't really remember why it got written out. I think it probably was budget, or maybe I just went like, oh my God, this is too much of a fucking lift. You know, there's a spirit of homage in everything I do. And I think most filmmakers who love movies, you see it in their movies. And I think there's no problem of acknowledging, like, here is a movie that is inspired by 100 movies that I love. But that one sequence to me was the thing that I just, it never left my head. I love it so much.
From a filmmaker's perspective as well, it seems like such an incredibly, when you look at it now, an incredibly constructed sequence where it's literally been planned to be edited as that amazing montage. It's not like they just like shot loads of different cameras and loads of different footage and then they managed to edit it together to rhythm with them. It's like so incredibly well thought out, and the amount of time it must have taken to do that, especially with everything being completely 100% practical. It boggles the mind, you know, when you like look at it and you think like, wow, how did they coordinate that with the real projected film footage that's on the screen that's being broken through and everything? It's just incredible.
Yeah. I love the motorcycle. It's so insane. The idea of a man riding a motorcycle through the auditorium of a movie theater and is swinging a machete at people, that to me is so 80s. You know, the idea that someone was just like, let's do this. Also, they drop a helicopter in the movie theater.
It's, I know,
you know, there's just this escalation that keeps happening in this movie that I find very energizing. And that's actually something I wanted to talk to you about, is the escalation, because I mentioned earlier that Argento contributed to the script, but there were four writers and there was sort of this behind the scenes thing where when Argento came in, he had a writer he wanted to work with, but there was already a writer attached and they sent one writer away and then they brought another writer back and then they brought the original writer back. And the original writer of the movie said that much of the beginning of the film is the same, except for the fact that he had always plotted to get to the demons faster. But then watching the movie, I'm like, we get there pretty fucking fast.
Fast enough, yeah.
I don't know how much quicker we could get there.
I know. This is the infamous Giordano Sacchetti, though, the writer who I love, admire, respect. I love his interviews as well, where he rips apart every single person he's ever worked with in his life. But, you know, he's the guy who says that Lucio Fulci was too logical. So maybe he's not the, you know, the best judge of like speed or logic or anything like that. I literally watched an interview with him. I got the wonderful new edition of The Church, the Severin 4K and everything. There's a great interview with him on that where he talks about how The Church began as Demons 3. But he begins by giving a kind of a potted history of his work on demons. And he is, of course, a wonderful screenwriter and comes up with great things. But there's so much of Bava. There's so much of Argento in terms of the characters and things. And the stuff that Argento, I think, didn't necessarily have the desire or maybe even slightly the courage to do in those days, because he was so considered so much more kind of respectable. And at least in Italy, I mean, as like the guy who did the big budget movies that were more serious. And in Demons, you see a lot of the stuff that he did in the 2000s. In movies like Mother of Tears and things that he'd never have done when he was making opera, for example. But he gets to at least support that, co-write it and produce it in a film like Demons and then Demons 2, etc.
I know I keep focusing on the fun of this film, but to me, there's a few movies that come out in this era. Return of the Living Dead, I think, is one. Mm-hmm. But also Demons, where it's like, how did they get this soundtrack pulled together? Mm-hmm. These are massive hits, some of them. And I'm just wondering, like, can you speak a little bit about the soundtrack and how a lot of it is very American for a film that's Italian that takes place in Germany. If you could talk about the soundtrack and how it kind of colors the experience of the film.
And it was one of the things that attracted me to Italian cinema in general when I was only familiar with the films of Argento and everything in the beginning, was the wonderful soundtracks. And also you have to remember, as I say, this would have been 89, 90. The soundtrack was still completely relevant. Still to this day, I'm a massive 80s aficionado. It's one of the reasons why I love this movie so much. But back then I was fully in my moment, and it was something that I thought was like, wow, all movies should be like this. This is the greatest thing. Like, you know, when people tend to write a lot of reviews nowadays about demons or phenomena or opera, they always sort of talk about the heavy metal and things like that. I loved it. I didn't have any problem with it. And I was not like the stereotypical like heavy metal fan by any means. I was much more into kind of like the Pet Shop Boys. But of course, yeah, there's Motley Crue and there's, but with people like Billy Idol and Go West, like I always think of that as being very English, very British, you know, and it's that very middle true. Of the road type thing. And then with the stronger heavy metal songs, I do think they're very Germanic, which fits perfectly into this Berlin setting and the end of the world thing. It's like an army that's coming to take over it. It seems perfectly in tune with the film.
You're absolutely right. I was stealing Billy Idol from you. I apologize. The only credit we can really take is Motley Crue. You're absolutely right.
Rick Springfield's on the soundtrack.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I'm not really thinking about Rick Springfield. Although I will say that even Rick Springfield, all of it is that 80s. Mm. Billy Idol, Motley Crue, Rick Springfield, in this soundtrack, there is a heavy metal 80s quality that is undeniably fabulous. And yes, I apologize. I had to interject and go, Billy Idol is absolutely
Billy Idol, equal parts LA, London. It's fine. It's like,
but he is British through and British. Through. But I was thinking, oh, Billy Idol, he's American. He's not American. I'm being silly.
But it is interesting because when you look at sort of this moment with Argento, leading into this film, his taking on this film as producer, he had just finished making Phenomena, which was really kind of the first time that he incorporated, in addition to the Goblin score and the Simon Boswell score, the fact that he put in pop music, air quotes, but it's like Megadeth or Iron Maiden. I can't remember which one.
Yeah, Iron Maiden.
It's Iron Maiden, yeah. And that was a big moment, and people were sort of jarred by it because prior to that, other than like the in-universe Rock Band and Four Flies and Grey Velvet, it was mostly the score that drove his movies. But you see him dabbling with pop culture music in Phenomena, and then he kind of moves over to produce this, and this movie is an onslaught of pop culture music. And I think that the two have to be linked in some way. It's sort of like Argento being like, I just did this, Lamberto, go with it. Only they could speak to that, you know, because that would be a behind the scenes conversation. But it feels like there's a synergy between those two moments.
There's a huge amount of crossover as well. It's like you've got some cast members in the minor roles of the people in the audience, like the guy who is having the affair with the niece of the blind man. And, you know, he has that scene where they're kissing and he gets strangled by the cord of the cinema. He is the real estate agent in Phenomena who like chases Jennifer Connelly away from the house that she goes to. Then you got Fiorio Argento in their only other role, except for years later. You know, she was the girl at the beginning of Phenomena. Then she's the young girl in Hannah in Demons, just because I'm so much into like the look of these films and so much, you know, into the 80s and everything. Like, you know, of course, I have the Giorgio Armani costumes in Phenomena, which are even used as a part of the plot in the film, the way she wears the logo on the back of her thing. And that's how the killer thinks the other girl is Jennifer. And then the two people who assisted him in the credits are the two ladies who actually do the costumes in Demons. And I think there's this big connection, right? If you could ever see like more 80s, like if you wanted to show someone in the future what people look like in the 80s, you should show them Phenomena and Demons, because at least they'll have a good impression.
Actually, it's funny that you say that, because we've covered a lot of movies on our podcast that have that sort of fantasy of the 80s, which was real, but it's also a select group. Again, I think of Return of the Living Dead, where, you know, it's this fantastic version of what punk rockers look like and dress like.
What would be expensive to dress like that?
As someone who was old enough to remember, it was a little grittier, a little dirtier, a little stinkier, a little less fashion, a little scarier. You know,
my only experience of like growing up, though, was that there were people in my family who did get up, like, it sounds ridiculous and it is ridiculous, but they get up 3 hours before they had to go to work in order to like do their hair and things, you know, to like get the big look and to do all the thing that would end up looking like someone in an 80s movie. No one would do that nowadays. It wouldn't even come into people's mindset. But people, I really do think, had that mindset of like making a impression. You know, you see it in family photos when you see people, you almost, you know, you look and you think, my God, were we going to some kind of premiere that night when everyone decided to, you know, but it was just something in the time.
Well, I have a question for you. As cool as I like to think that I am, and worldly and international, I'm ashamed to admit that I've only been to Berlin once in my life. I attended the Berlinale and I did a showgirls event, and that's it. I've never been to Berlin ever since. And one of the great regrets I have is that I know the Metropole Theater still stands. Now, it's not a cinema, but I've even heard that there's been events there, Demons affiliated, and I am so jealous. So I'm wondering, have you been able to visit the sacred?
I have.
Tell us about it.
It was one of the first places I went to when I went to Berlin. I haven't attended anything inside. It's like the premier queer area of Berlin now. And it was even when it was West Berlin back in the 80s when they made Demons. It wasn't so much a theater then. It was used as a concert venue. And people like David Bowie and Depeche Mode and performers like this would actually perform in the Metropole as their like main venue when they came to West Berlin at the time. So all that like neon sign that says Metropole outside, that was all like real. That was what it was. That sign's different now. And it's all cleaned up and nice and shiny, but it's a really interesting area. There's like great bars around and different places to go. There's the German, or at least the Berlin main AIDS memorial is like just on the next block along from the building and everything. So it's very much a thing for fans and especially queer fans to go and see, because it's like a great area of Berlin to go and see as well. And really nearby is the metro station where she gets off at the beginning as well. And you have that whole wonderful scene where she's being pursued with the mask. That looks identical. Literally nothing has changed at all.
That's amazing.
I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot, Alex. In Demons, and one of the draws for everyone here is that kind of intermingling of the art on the screen versus what's happening in the theater, where art is horror and horror is art. Mm-hmm. And in The Latent Image, which people can now watch on streaming or on DVD, your protagonist is writing a book. And as he's writing the book, the horror of the fiction of the horror of reality start kind of intermingling. And as someone who is so devoted to Italian horror, how much of your love of these kinds of movies did you bring to the writing of Latent Image?
All of it. It's also because I kind of feel like these films, either they fit me or I fit them just kind of perfectly. And some people love them, but they kind of have problems with them. You know, they have problems with the dubbing or the logic or the lack of a resolution or anything. And I don't know why. Maybe it's because I was young enough, or I honestly don't know. None of it ever bothered me. I actually always found it so refreshing and so much better that I didn't know why something was happening, or did that happen because, or like, I thought she was connected with it in some way. Oh no, they've killed her. Oh, why did they do that? Oh, we don't know. I found that wonderful. Like, I never had any problems with that. And I never found it sort of kitsch or campy or anything. Like, I always took them very seriously, having fun with them and enjoying them, but I never found them as things to kind of make fun of or think that they were lesser than like a normal movie. I always kind of found them was something that was a little bit beyond. And in terms of like when you write in the latent image, when I was writing the latent image and everything, it just let me be a little bit free, in the sense that, well, it was kind of being created on a very small scale. It wasn't like there were people telling us what to do. You can do something and you may not have to like perfectly dot all the I's and cross the T's, but the right people will get it, hopefully. And then you can kind of relax into it. And so thinking of the Italian films always made me do that.
I love that. That makes total sense. And I love the way that you articulated it, for sure. When we get a movie and it's one that I'm as big a nerd for as our guests, which honestly isn't always the case. Sometimes we do movies where I discover a new love for the film. And sometimes once in a while, not very often, we do movies where I go, oh, I don't think I like that as much as I thought I did. This is one of those movies where my love affair with the film was immediate, and it has never wavered. And in fact, if anything, I think it's deepened over the years, especially as a creative who sees how much it's influenced me. I'm excited that you're as big a fan as I am. And what I'm realizing talking to you is we get a lot of these Uber fans who show up and they're wearing the t-shirt and they have, you know, the ephemera in the background. And as I'm looking at you, because I can see you, I'm realizing, and I'm a nerd, I have a Wicker Man t-shirt on right now. Michael knows I have the posters. I live it. I don't have Demons anything. And I'm realizing it as I'm talking to you. So I have to ask, do you have Demons anything? Do you collect anything?
I no longer have my original VHSs, which is for shame, but I got rid of them all in the 90s when I was like upgrading to formats and things. But I have original Laserdisc. I have the soundtrack on original 80s vinyl and cassette. which were mine at the time. And then I also have them on modern vinyl. And my Pride and Joy, which I don't have out at all because it's too big. You can't get a frame for it. And also it's like, I want to keep it nice. I have the Demons and Demons 2, the original, I think they're called Quattrofogli Italian posters, which are enormous. They're like twice the size of a house door.
Put next you have to those?
Yeah, I have one for Demons and one for Demons 2.
You're my hero.
Years ago in Italy when no one cared, like they would have just like maybe got rid of them or given them away for €10 or something. And
where are they?
Folded up in the top of a wardrobe.
Alex, now I know it's going to be a small fortune to get those properly framed. But do a GoFundMe, something.
He needs to get his next movie funded first.
The sad reality, though, is I live in a teeny tiny apartment in San Francisco. I would have nowhere to put those because I know what you're talking about. Those are gorgeous, giant posters. Yeah.
I shockingly have a couple bits of Demons memorabilia. I have a bobblehead of Rosemary.
Amazing.
Oh,
friend Mark Murray, he had this company that made European horror icons into bobbleheads. And I have Jean Rollin and Fulci, and I have a Rosemary. And I also have a replica of the Metropole ticket that I think Giretta gave me once upon a time. So
that's cool. Ooh, that Giretta gave me.
All right. Alex, you mentioned, because we've talked about it a couple times over the course of the interview, you referenced the fact that Demons 3, The Ogre, sort of a tenuously connected sequel, and how the church was meant to be a Demons sequel and then became its own thing. You mentioned having a poster for Demons 2. What is your relationship with the Demons sequels? Do you like them? Are they their own thing?
I love Demons 2 now. And when I was a kid and first saw it, which was like the weekend after I'd seen Demons, I loved it and then thought, but why didn't they do like, you know, Alien to Aliens? Why didn't we see how the world had ended? Why didn't we see them all run around and everything? But I still loved the movie for what it actually was. My favorite main title score on any Italian horror film is Simon Boswell's piece of music for Demons 2. I just think that piece of music is fantastic. I listen to that quite often. But in terms of the film, I was disappointed then. Over the years, I've kind of thought, well, yeah, of course, you know, I've just talked about how Italian horror doesn't follow those rules. Why would it have to show you what happened next chronologically? Why wouldn't it put two of the same actors in two completely different roles that don't have anything to, you know, it's Demons 2. It's making its own movie. I think they just didn't have a sense of what people then in America, in Britain, thought a sequel was. I mean, it was the very first movie ever made in Italy that had a two. Like, they'd never had that before, ever.
Ah, that's interesting. Never knew that.
I didn't either.
I think we should do a Midnight Mini Mass on Demons 2, because selfishly, I would love to do a reevaluation. And of course, Alex, if you have the time and you want to come on and talk about it. Okay.
Yeah. I was going to drop in a little tidbit of something that I was thinking of that I might actually save for that then now. So.
Okay, go ahead and save it. Here's our plug, because I want to reevaluate Demons 2. You know, we just did Return to Oz. That's one where, as an adult now, especially hearing all the things that our listeners experienced growing up with that movie, that I have a full new appreciation for that film. You know, it's not a sequel, but it's, you know, it's a bizarre anomaly. Demons 2, I need to give another look, because I loved Demons so much that when I saw Demons 2, I exactly wanted what you described. It didn't deliver, but I need to go back and rewatch it. Now I just want to go back and listen to the music.
That main theme, I could listen to all day. I just think it's like so good. A bit of an unsung hero, I think, Simon Boswell. Like, he always gets forgotten off the name of the, you know, the people like Claudio Simonetti and of course the rest of Goblin and everything. And then I actually have that soundtrack as well on the original 80s vinyl, which is of course all the new wave, the Smiths and the Cults and the Art of Noise. And it's like a completely different soundscape, which I think must have come from him.
Yeah, it's why earlier when I was mentioning the score to Phenomena, I made sure to say, because a lot of people automatically apply the Goblin label because of Argento, and they were responsible for the score, but they did it in kind of conjunction with Simon Boswell. They both contributed to the score of that movie. But Goblin is so omnipresent, especially in the world of Argento, that it's really easy to steamroll anybody, unless it's like Ennio Morricone, who worked on an Argento movie. It is really good to give Simon Boswell his cookies, you know?
And I actually love that movie, but I know nothing really happens and the end doesn't really work, but I love that you watch this horror writer trying to get inspiration, remembering your childhood nightmares, wandering around a beautiful castle castle for an hour and a half with this beautiful Simon Boswell score, amazing photography, and a little bit spooky. And it's a film I really like, but I always think of it as The House of the Ogre, not really Demons Through the Ogre.
Sergio Stivaletti?
Is it Stivaletti, yeah.
Stivaletti, I forget who the DP is. Of course, the production designer of this film. The production design, the lighting, the practical effects, there's all this stuff that, like, I'm realizing, like, oh my God, I could just talk all day about demons, because the costumes, as you know, it's just perfect. It's one of those movies where when you break it down and you go like, oh yeah, they hit it 10 out of 10, 10 out of 10, practical effects, gore, the demonic transformations, the set pieces, you know, the fact that there's a Dario Argento movie poster in the background. I love all that stuff. You know, it just tickles me. So I want to say to the listeners, we would be here all day if we broke apart everything we loved about this movie. But I did want to ask about the practical effects. Today, I feel like we're just sort of cheated out of a lot of that practical design and work. What did you think of the effects in the film?
I found them incredible. And I kind of come to it from, I think, like a lot of people who were children in the 80s, you know, meaning pre-teenagers really, where there were so many programs on TV and magazines and articles about how you did this stuff that it became kind of a thing that you went to a film to see. There was a children's BBC TV program about the same time, would have been 89, 90, maybe 88. So I'm like 7, 8 years old. And it was about how Bob Keane's crew did the makeup effects in Hellbound Hellraiser 2. Mm. And that's on like children's BBC at 4:30 in the afternoon, because it's a British film and they're showing how they did the effects, you know? So there was a lot of that. It wasn't like this forbidden territory. And I actually, like I told you, I came to the film by seeing that clip where they showed a part of the transformation that was very censored and edited. And then they showed you all the teeth they'd made, and they showed you the animatronic, and they deconstructed the animatronic, took the wig off, took the face off, everything, showed you how it worked. And so that was kind of a big part of interest for me. I always knew there were effects, and I always wanted to see how far could you go, what could you do. But at the same time, now as we've gone so far away from that type of era, I really realize how viscerally effective those effects are versus things that we see done digitally, which can be incredible and wonderful and fantastic. But they miss this. I learned a new word recently when I was trying to figure out why I prefer film shot on film, especially when you see like 4K discs of a film shot on film 20 years ago, and it looks better than a 4K disc of a film that was made recently with the Alexa. You can kind of see textures, and you can kind of literally feel the thing by looking at it. You feel like you can feel it, and it gives you that sensation. And right. When something is like shot on film or practical or physical, that's how kind of your mind's working, I think. Like you're feeling the texture of, oh yeah, someone is grabbing some slimy thing that, okay, it's made of foam latex, but it's very, very close to skin. That's why, you know, like the shark in Jaws, when it's coming at Roy Scheider, doesn't matter how many people say it looks fake. You're like, oh my God, there's a 25-foot long thing being rammed in a man's face.
It makes a huge difference than when your mind knows that it's coming from a computer. You know, I do think computer effects are infinitely better than they were. We just talked about on the Mini Mass Patreon, Godzilla Minus One. It felt like they were mixing practical water with CGI, and, you know, they're really getting it better, but it still doesn't compare. I don't care if it looks cheesy or ridiculous, like Belial in Basket Case.
Yeah.
It wouldn't work if it looked like some fabulous computer made growth coming out of them. I don't care that it looks like a cheesy puppet. The actor sells it.
Sometimes when you speak to people who've only grown up with the CGI movies, sometimes they have the opposite way of thinking. They think that if it looks like it was in the room, somehow that makes it fake. I mean, this is what I've got from just conversation, just like random anecdotes, but like, it's not necessarily it looks cheesy, but oh yeah, you can see it's in the room. So someone must be puppeteering it. And so it's fake. Versus the idea that,
idiots.
I mean, obviously, we want, when we make movies, for things to look as good as possible and feel as authentic as possible. But there is a part of me, and maybe it's because it's the kind of movie I grew up with. In some ways, I want to bring artifice back to movies. Like, you know, you see this idea of like, if there's a string pulling the monster and you see it, like, who cares? This is make-believe. Like, you don't go and see Wicked and like think that Idina Menzel's flying on stage. You know that like it's, you know, it's
part
fake.
Of the fun of it, right? We've never discussed this on this podcast, but it makes me think of something else that drives me nuts about young people and in some ways old people, because the old people don't actually know what's going on. They're just kind of clueless. And the young people actually think that it's better. Mm-hmm. And what I'm talking about, and I don't know if they do it in England, but in the US, if you buy a new television, they have a setting that is changing the frame rate. And it gives this sort of video soap opera effect that young people think looks better. I fucking hate it. It's the least cinematic. So do they do that in England? Put shit on that?
I know what you're talking about, but I've never seen it in anyone's TV that I know, but I only see it in TV showrooms. You know, when they're trying to sell the TV and they'll have it on, but...
Yeah. Actually, the TVs come with it, and it is so complicated now to try to figure out how to change the setting. I don't get it. It is a nightmare. In fact, any Airbnb I'm at, any hotel that has it, I will spend the 20 minutes to look on YouTube and figure out how to change it, or I will not watch their television.
All of the American televisions are preset to it is because of sports. It's for people who buy television for sports.
No wonder I hate it.
Right. Last question, getting back to the movie. Alex, you talk about discovering Demons via the documentary and then receiving the VHS tape. Obviously, you love this movie. It shines brightly. So you've been talking about this movie and loving this movie for years. But from that first time discovering the movie to now, how has your relationship with Demons changed, if at all?
I think I actually love it even more because I now realize so many of the things that it is putting in there without making them the story. Like the entire amount of paranoid fears of an 8-year-old boy from Liverpool at the end of the 80s, start of the 90s, are in that movie. Like, they're literally in that movie, right down to setting it in Berlin, you know, which was going to be like where the nuclear war was going to start. Like, every single thing is in the movie. And you only fully appreciate it, I think, when you get into that kind of analytical phase. And, you know, I wrote a paper about this film when I was in university, and that, you know, and you start to like really go into that everything, and it's all there. It's all there, but it doesn't feel the need to draw attention to it. It just lets it happen, and you either get it or you don't get it. And of course, all these years later, you can't not get it. It's like everything's so obvious. It's like a stream of consciousness about all the different social fears of the time, you know, all the fear people had of contagion and of punks that were going to do things and the urban decay. It's as socio-political as any George Romero movie. And I love George Romero movies. And one of the things I love about him is that he'll construct characters and situations that really tell you a parable through it. Demons doesn't do that, but it still has all the stuff in there. It's just kind of throwing it at you.
Well, Alex, we cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. Breaking news. Here's the exclusive. If you're a Patreon subscriber, we are doing a Midnight Mini Mass on Demons 2. I am so excited. We'll schedule that offline. But Alex, thank you. And I look forward to us speaking again very soon.
Me too. Yeah, thank you. Can't wait.
That was our interview with filmmaker Alex Buerl, all about his love of this movie, Demons. And I thought he was so thoughtful. What a great interview.
Yeah, I love that he took to heart so many of the things that he learned from Italian horror and brought it to his own craft and continues to investigate the movies and learn from them. You know, whenever you're growing up as a horror fan and trying to express to others who maybe aren't into it as much as you are, why you love this, so many people dismiss this genre as sort of being superficial or just gross or for shock value alone. But people like Alex are a great example of the fact that there is so much to gain from this and so much to learn and so much artistry can be seen and gleaned. And I think that it's really important for fellow horror fans who are maybe in a place that have friends and family not understanding their love of these things, to look at people like Alex or many of the guests that we've had on the show who have taken their love of horror and brought it to their personal and professional lives, and it continues to enrich and teach them.
Speaking of continuing to investigate, you heard it on the show just now. Alex will be joining us. We've committed him on record to join us for a further examination of the Demon sequel, Demons 2, which is one of the fastest made sequels ever. I mean, it came out the following year, you know. I mean, I know that happens, but it's impressive when they can turn it around that quickly and actually make it good. So Alex will be joining us over on our Patreon for a midnight mini mass on Demons 2. I'm looking forward to that. As I said, I haven't seen that movie in a long, long time. So I'm really excited about diving back in and kind of looking at it with fresh eyes. Our Patreon is better than ever. I've been having a lot of fun posting the most random stuff. Michael knows I've been sharing things that actually have never been shared before. Most recently, I discovered an old interview on a hard drive of myself and Heklina, the late great friend Heklina, and I interviewing Bianca Del Rio for a podcast that Heklina went on and did without me. Now, that actually was not as shady or hurtful as it sounds. She and I wanted to do a podcast called Drag Time, and we started it with this interview with Bianca Del Rio, which never got released. And then I got distracted with other projects, to be fair. And Heklina was kind of like, bitch, what's up with Drag Time? Like, and I said, I just don't have the time. If you want to go for it, just go for it. And she did.
She did.
And so Heklina's podcast, which I love, and I'm so glad that she did because, you know, she's no longer with us. And it's really, I mean, just to be able to hear her cackle and her voice and her sick sense of humor is wonderful. But this is a lost interview, and I just shared it on the Patreon. I know it has nothing to do with Bava or Demons, but I did want to give our Patreon a plug and let you know that Michael and I are going to continue to put up weird nuggets and never before heard things, including an interview with our guest about Demons 2. So look for that coming soon.
I think that our Patreon is a lot of fun. And I think that we do a really good job about tying in some extra special exclusive tidbits to our main feed episodes. But then it wouldn't be us if we didn't go a little off book, right?
That's right. And I love tidbits. So we will continue to welcome you all with open arms over there at the Patreon. And we're just very, very grateful because the support that you give us, it literally pays for our brilliant editor, Heather. Doesn't quite yet pay Michael or I, but we love doing this show and we are glad that we get to pay someone for their hard work. I mean, that, and Heather deserves it. She's the unsung hero of the show. I mean, she's listening to this right now. She'll be the first to fucking tell you that I require a lot of edits. She loves telling us that. In fact, she tells us how many edits she makes sometimes. And I'm like, okay, whatever, bitch. You get paid, so edit it away. Now what'll be interesting, Michael, is will she leave this in the show or will she cut it? I guess the listeners will never know if she does.
That's true. Anyway, back to Demons. Earlier when I was talking—
Well, we were talking about Heather, so—
Well, the connection
Demons.
Is
she's a demon.
One of the things that we celebrated in the intro about Demons is just all of the various punk rock ties it has. And Heather
that's
is truly
true.
Punk rock.
Yes, that's true.
When I was talking about Alex after his interview, I mentioned how we take these movies and how they continue to enrich us and we investigate and celebrate them in different ways. And our next guest is someone who really puts that on display. They took their love of Italian horror and found a whole different avenue with which to explore that. And it's also someone that you and I both know and have worked with.
I don't know if this person would officially consider me their drag mother, but in many ways, I think they should. And you'll find out why when you listen to the episode. But one of the things I love about this next guest is their taste level. They're a young person who I've known since they were very young, and they've always had great taste in culture, art, movies, music. And so the fact that they're such a big Demons fan and that we could have had them on for many movies because they're one of these cinephiles who like a lot of stuff, but their interest in cinema is heavily centered around Italian horror and the world of Argento. And that's why we've brought them on to speak with us today. It's Andrew Sheets, aka Meredith, right now.
Welcome back, listeners. When it comes to celebrating Italian horror, few people do it quite like our next guest. Alongside Gillian Narling, this individual was the co-creator of the sensational Stereo Argento live event series, which celebrated the mystique of international horror through live performance in a club night environment. Beyond this, this person was a longtime member of the Frameline Film Festival family, serving as the driving force behind the creation and curation of Frameline Fangs, a celebration of fright within the historic LGBTQ film festival. On screen, they've appeared in numerous film projects, including Michael Phyllis's The Bride of Death, Ben De La Creme's Capitol Hill TV series, and queer techno-horror Unusual Attachment, which was written and directed by me. Behind the camera, this person is an amazing filmmaker and talent, serving as the writer, producer, and director of their own brilliant projects, such as the isolationist piece Alone Not Alone. A performer, nightlife producer, and visual artist, this person also has a long history with the world of Peaches Christ stage shows.
That's right. Okay, let's hear it for a joint intro. Actually, this might be an unprecedented moment because we never do this, but I just wanted to jump in here and say I've had the pleasure of watching this person from the time they were a youthful college student and I was their professor of all things. And they were in three different classes I taught, at least two. I got to watch them in one of our classes not only become another version of themselves, but really show me how talented they are. And because of this, I was able to cast them in multiple shows over the years and in many projects. Without further ado, let's hear it for Meredith, aka Andrew Sheets.
Hi, that was so cool. I love
that. Was a chunky intro.
Yeah, my gosh.
Meredith, will you remind me, were you in three classes that I did? You were in Creating Character, where you created Meredith.
Creating Character.
And you were in the Girls on Film, which was the history of
Girls on Film,
the history of drag on screen in cinema. And then were you also in the cult film class I did with the cult movies in the city?
I wasn't. No, itch. I was just in the other two. But I know, I wish I was. I think that it filled up too quickly. I mean, your classes filled up like at the blink of an eye. It was pretty outstanding. It was the talk of the town that Peaches was teaching at SFAI.
It was, yeah, rest in peace. You and I were like the last of a generation because during the pandemic, the truly historic San Francisco Art Institute, which was the most important art institute west of the Mississippi for forever, ended up shuttering its doors and closing. And now the building, including a giant Diego Rivera, you know, mural, just sit atop a hill and we're all waiting to see what happens next.
My gosh, maybe that's where the Terror Vault moves.
That would be, oh my God, can you imagine?
Buy it, just buy it, yeah.
You heard it here first, no. Yeah. So before we jump into Demons, I mentioned at the top of the intro, Stereo Argento, which was born out of your love of Italian horror and the work of Argento in general. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because I think it's really relevant to what leads you here to talk about Demons with us today. I want people who were not lucky enough to go see that show while it was in San Francisco to understand how you took your love of this subgenre of horror and created a whole event out of it.
The Stud Bar, famously, in San Francisco, was taken over by the Stud Collective. There was like all these individuals that kind of went in and were like the first group of folks to kind of open up like a space like that as a collective. And with that came like kind of all this new programming. So when we were approached to do one of their Friday night spots, it was very exciting. And I just happened to be in the thralls of investigating all of the work of Dario Argento and just like watching all those movies. And then sitting down with Gillian Narling, who's the co-creator of Dario Argento, just thinking about how to package that very distinct style and that distinct tone and how that would translate into a nightlife environment. First of all, the films are so visual. So like that's something that you definitely want at a party or at an event. The content as well was so draggy already that that was very easy to offer as, you know, kind of a prompt to our performers as well. The content and the style of those films is also just so unique that it was able to really carve out a space for us, like in the identity of the Stud that was so unique. I loved all of those parties, like Honey Mahogany's Black Friday, Vivi's Grand Opening. Those were all so unique in their own way and really offered like this wide array of San Francisco drag, like any Friday of the month. And with Stereo Argento, like that brought out the film nerds, the freaks, the weirdos, the dorks.
It was queer horror, you know? It was queer horror
exactly.
Before the explosion of Dragula. And, you know, of course, my grandma self is always loving when there's sort of a torch being passed. And I was lucky enough, and we talk about this a lot on the podcast, to sort of arrive in San Francisco at a time when, you know, the Sick and Twisted Players were wrapping up, but I got to see their stuff like, you know, Texas Chainsaw 90210 posters. And, you know, they would do Friday the 13th parodies, and it was so fucking inspiring. And so I was able to take this sort of drag community's inspiration and can kind of continue making stuff. And that's how Midnight Mass was born. But certainly Tranny Shack, which was at the Stud and where I got my start, you know, in 1996, was a place where, I mean, my numbers in the early years were all peaches and chainsaws and guts and, you know, I mean, very Argento and a lot of horror. And what I loved about that period of drag was you could go to a Tranny Shack and an entire night would be dedicated to David Lynch. And then the next week it would be Madonna night or whatever. And so it really kind of ran the gamut. What you all did, which I it was so impressed me, was took one of those niche themes that we might do at Tranny Shack once, you know, like an Argento night, which is, to my memory, I don't believe ever happened. I would remember. And you made a whole club out of it that ran for a long time in that intersection between Argento and drag, and the opulence of those films is so incredible. So kudos to you. And one of the things that we should probably say is, yes, we are aware that Bava directed Demons. We know that. But we also are very aware that Argento produced it, and Argento's fingerprints.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the Toby Hoop, Steven Spielberg co-production of Poltergeist, where it's like, you know what? Two creative people can work together and it's okay. One can be a producer and one can be a director, and both of them can be creatively involved in the making of a masterpiece. So Demons, when did you first see it? Why do you love it? I'm assuming you love it as we do.
I do. Yeah, of course. Jeez. I first saw Demons. It was, again, right around the time where Sergio Argento came into being. Like, this all things aligned at the same time. It was around Halloween, and I gave myself an assignment to watch a horror film that I had never seen before that everyone in the community talks about all the time. So I watched a different film every day of the month of October, and Demons happened to be one of them. A lot of them were a lot of those, like, Argento, Bava, Giallo films. And I just fell in love with the absurdity of it and the meta-ness of it. And I like the different kind of chapters within the rise of Italian horror cinema. And like the 80s for me is just like a very unique flavor. And this one is just so 80s to me, like in the styling and the rise of like kind of zombie behavior and interest at that time too. And, you know, it reminded me a lot of your film, All About Evil, and kind of the idea of like these people being trapped in the movie theater. And I couldn't not think of that when I was watching the movie.
I love that you zero in on the 80s of it all, because I think when looking at, say, the works of Argento by himself, especially the works leading up to this, there, of course, are movies that are a little more of the moment than others, but he often enters this kind of space of highbrow meets gore. You know, it's an opera. It's some sort of high art, high society. And that's where that giallo, you know, the beauty and the grotesque intermingle. And I think this is where Lamberto Bava really shows himself as the director of the film and the creative force, because he's sort of bringing that gru that Argento does and takes it out of the opera house and puts it into a multiplex. And you've got like all of these like amazing like 80s stereotypes that, while they exist sort of in other Italian works, it's sort of like Bava looking at American cinema and being like, no, no, we want this, but our version of it. And you get kind of like the puffy jackets and the big hair and like the big gore. And so I kind of want to talk about the characters. Do you have like a favorite character in this movie? Is it the aesthetic that works? Or is it just the overall package?
Oh, God, my favorite character is clearly the girl that walks around with a flashlight. And she clearly works at the redhead.
The usherette.
Hair and the green drink. Yeah. The usherette. Yeah, she's so fierce. I would, like, love her entire look. And, you know, I obviously love, like, the three, like, baddies who are, like, smoking throughout the movie, who obviously, like, kind of kick the whole thing off. And yeah, just like you're saying, like they have every freaking archetype box ticked. Like you've got like the punks, you've got like, you know, the kind of like quote unquote final girl and her love interest and all that. I love seeing how just like different.
Even the sex workers and the way they're portrayed is so 80s, right? With the pimp and the hookers, you know, but everyone's kind of fabulous.
Absolutely. And you could just tell that they were all having a lot of fun too.
Yeah. One of the things that I love about this film is the marketing for it. I love the font for the logo, for the Demons logo. Mm-hmm. I love all the different versions of the posters. And, you know, as a fan of a lot of this stuff, for all that love, and you both know me really well, like I am the biggest dork when it comes to out of drag clothing. It's black jeans and horror movie t-shirts, or sometimes drag t-shirts, or maybe new wave t-shirts, but a lot of horror movie t-shirts. And I was just thinking, I've never owned a Demons t-shirt. So I'm wondering, Meredith, do you have any Demons ephemera? Are you a collector of Argento or Italian horror stuff? Is that something you do?
I'm really not. I mean, I say that as I'm wearing Argento
you are, yes,
t-shirt
yes.
And looking at the exact same print as a framed poster in my room. But no, I'm not like a huge collector. It's not really how I like to express myself, but I think it's really fierce that you do, Peaches.
Look, I own that I'm a dork, you know, no doubt. But I also am not much of a collector of shit because I love it too much. Like, I do have some one sheets. I have boxes of 35 millimeter trailers that I've kept from, you know, all those screenings. And I wear the t-shirts, but I get rid of them a lot. In fact, I bring them in about every 3 or 4 months. I bring in a box of t-shirts to Terror Vault and they're just put out on a window ledge and any of the cast can take whatever they want because, you know, I'm excited about wearing them a few times, but then after you know, so I can't collect very much because I live in a really small apartment, you know, I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're already plastered. I mean, I've been there. Every square inch is pretty much taken.
I know, right? Yeah.
So a question for both of you, because we talked about when discussing Stereo Argento, the inherent drag qualities of sort of the body of work of Argento. And we're talking about the fabulousness and the specific looks of these characters in Demons. And we talked a lot about sort of the filmmaking and the setup with the other guest. And because of the unique perspectives you both bring, taking film and bringing it to a drag stage, what would you both say are the best drag elements of Demons? Like, if you were going to take this and bring it to your stage, how would you do it?
There's like a couple layers there where like these people are clearly playing these different, you know, 80s archetypes, moviegoers. But then there's like a clear shift. You can like tell when they're put into their demon drag, when they're like finally like up in demon drag, you can tell that like they kind of just completely take on this new character. And for me, like that's like the biggest drag element of the film is just kind of that transition of seeing like the face full of makeup, colored contacts, fake teeth, prosthetics. Like it just is drag. And I love that.
This is colored contacts before queens were using them, right? This is like the appropriate use of colored contacts because all the queens now use them. But like, this is when you should really be using them as an homage to these demons. The makeup is so fantastic. But as Meredith already mentioned, it's already drag because of the 80s, the fabulous over-the-top fashion. There's sex workers, there's pimps, there's 80s clothing galore. Plus, the other thing that makes it so ripe for a drag show, unlike a lot of Argento movies, is that in this movie, Bava uses a ton of pop music from the era. And so, mm-hmm. you know, you can do numbers to Motley Crue, you know, or Billy Idol. Like, that's amazing. And it's pulled directly from the film. So the other thing about this movie is it's just so much fun. And then, as we've discussed, it's sort of meta in a way, because if you do it kind of like All About Evil, if you do the show in a movie theater, you can turn the movie theater, you know, you can have a motorcycle in the foyer if you want. That's where I would go, is I would start turning it into the Berlin cinema experience, you know, so that when the audience walked in, I mean, it really is insane that there's never been a Midnight Mass Demons screening. Now that I think about it. Yet, exactly. We could still make it happen. Maybe Meredith, that's where you and I could reconnect. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about your general love of horror. And I think for the listeners, and I know I keep calling you Meredith, and I know that you're not performing in drag as often, but I loved that character so much. And I wonder if you could talk about creating an entire drag persona that really was, as far as I know, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, what I remember from being in class with you, it was a real sort of melting pot of final girls that you kind of pulled together all of these different iconic stories from all these strong women, mostly from slasher films, and you created this drag character, this archetype of a final girl called Meredith. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it all started with taking your class, creating character, and Meredith was where I wanted to, or where I needed to start, really. The whole reason I signed up for this class is that I knew that she was in there because, I mean, I've been like a horror fan since, you know, probably like 11 or 12 is when I first started to really, you know, watch all of those DVDs from Blockbuster and stuff. And from there, I always was obsessed with the slasher genre. And I would always just like run around the house and pretend I was in my own, you know, slasher film. And they were sickening. Like, I should have been, you know, filming that stuff. But that was my form of play growing up. And, you know, then I got into like the visual arts, and then I ended up going to art school, but then wound up in this weird new genres program, which was, you know, for the freaks, the performance artists, the video makers and all of that. And there was this creating character class with Peaches Christ. So I knew it wasn't specifically a drag class. It wasn't a drag factory. Your character didn't even need to be drag. It was all about character studies. But for me, I knew that I wanted to do drag. I knew that I wanted to try it. And I knew that the character that I identified the most with was this girl. And it was this girl in this specific type of movie. And I really wanted to flesh that out. So yeah, I mean, I started just taking inspiration from all of the final girls that I love, like Sally from Texas Chainsaw, and just kind of thinking about how to make that character exist outside of just like a film and kind of make her more of an entertainer. And so I thought, oh God, what if her name is like Mara Death, like instead of Meredith? And like the reason she's like kind of got that name is because death just follows her. Like, what if she's kind of this permanent final girl where like it's this curse? I don't know if you remember, but her original name was Meredith Kurtz. I tried to make that sickening, but it's not.
As you're talking, I remember the narrative of like she just kept losing all of her friends, which I love. It was kind of like the opposite of Final Destination, where the horror is that you're the only one who survives, but everyone around you dies. So smart, Andrew. It was so smart, and you were so good at it. And also, I loved that it was kind of anti-drag in a way. Like, you didn't do over-the-top clown paint. You didn't do big, giant wigs and stuff. Also, just for the listeners who don't know or haven't seen Meredith or don't know Andrew, this person is naturally gifted with the longest legs and thin physique. You could kind of look like a supermodel as a scream queen, which was amazing with very little. Oh, I miss Meredith.
I know. And but that's like also too why what started with drag and as a character study of all of that. And it kind of always was just in the background. I kind of was just like making micro movies with my drag numbers. Like, it was kind of like, it was more about creating situations for this person and creating narratives and like different contexts that I could like bring to this that were so unusual. But somehow I wanted to make them approachable enough where you would kind of just get it. Like, the number would start with me like running from something, flashlight in hand, and you would kind of already know the narrative of what's going on there. So as much as I like loved being in drag and all of that, it really was just about like storytelling and story making and these situations that I really wanted to investigate and see how they landed and all that kind of stuff.
I remember during the first year of the pandemic, you know, when people were doing digital drag shows and so many performers would, because they had to, do setups just like on the wall at their place. And then you would come on with this like preset video where you had been out shooting and like running in the night in your drag. And it was always like a mini film. And it was just so evident that's where your passion lied. Like, Meredith was not just going to like do it against a wall in her place. She was going to make a little movie for you.
That's why drag for me was actually kind of so difficult because like I wouldn't do anything. I mean, like I said, I would really have to create a whole world, but it's just how I approached this medium of art. It's just how I wanted to do it. And it was like five times more work than it needed to be, but that's just how these things came to
me. Now, you were talking about how the creation of the Meredith character came from sort of a culmination of the love of Final Girls. And sort of these different women who had their own brand of death curse. And so bringing us a little bit back to Demons, let's talk about the not-so-final girl of this movie, because she doesn't really necessarily make it to the end. She makes it like 99.9% to the end. But what's your take of our lead character? She sort of is more of a cipher than a lot of final girls, I feel, but maybe you have a different thought.
For me, she's pretty copy and paste, if I'm being honest. Like, just even how we're introduced to her kind of like on the subway platform, and for some reason her anxiety is already at 100. Like, just a person that happens to also be on the subway platform is like, you know, a threat to her. Like, she immediately starts running. That's a Meredith character. Like, why does she already think that she's in her own movie and this person is after her and all this stuff? I mean, turns out he is, but like, you know, we're kind of teased where it's like, no, he's just promoting some show or whatever. So like, she kind of just is that. And then, you know, it's like, oh, hot guy. And then it's like, oh, she falls for the hot guy. And yeah, so I found her like very integral to the entire story, as like these characters always are. Everything revolves around them. But for me, yeah, I think she just showed up, did the final girl job, and yeah, almost made it to the end. But then with these goofy 80s movies, you always need to have like that last, you know, shock. So that was really fun to see that happen to our girl.
One of the things that, of course, we love about these 80s horror movies are the practical effects and the makeup, which we've discussed a little bit. And this film has fabulous gore. Now, you're wearing an opera shirt, Dario Argento's opera. It's a fabulous shirt. And when we first were diving into this, I learned that, I don't know if I'm going to say it correctly, Sergio Stivaletti, I believe, who did all of the gore and special effects on opera, was brought in to do Demons. And I love his work. Both films, the gore is just so great. I'm wondering if you have a favorite makeup look or gore moment, or is there a special effect that pops out to you?
It has to be the actual demon popping out of the back of her friend. Like,
yes.
That's where you get like the true like puppeteering in there. It's just like dialed up to 100. Also early on, one of the kills where two people are making out kind of conspicuously behind the curtain, she strangles them both with a rope and they're kind of asphyxiated while making out, and like that's how they're killed. And I think that that's an extremely iconic kill in the film. But yeah, I mean, everything is just so good. How the teeth grow in, how the claws grow in, how those pustules explode.
Yes.
How people are just vomiting. It's just all good. And if it wasn't practical, it would have been so bad. But since it's practical, it just looks so good and so of its time.
So juicy.
It is juicy. This is a juicy movie. Do you have any relationship or feelings on Demons 2?
Absolutely. I love Demons 2. I had rewatched Demons recently, and to prepare for this, I just watched Demons 2. And for some reason, I had this in my mind that it was like almost like a Gremlins 2 kind of thing, where it was like, let's just throw everything in there. But then I was like, oh, no, it's actually not as crazy as I remember it to be. But it's kind of just like that extra level of meta where now it's kind of out into the world through media. Demons 2 is a kind of like a perfect sequel in that way, where it's exactly what you want.
I think it's funny that you bring up the Gremlins sequel, because there's something about certain sequels, I guess. It's not Poltergeist 2, maybe it's Part 3, and Evil Dead Rise, where eventually a high-rise apartment building becomes a location for sequels. I never thought about that before. What was the other one I was thinking of? Well, Gremlins, in some ways, you know. Anyway, I actually haven't seen Demons 2 in a long time, but we have promised our Patreon listeners that we are going to do a midnight mini mass and do a deeper dive into Demons 2. So I'm looking forward to a rewatch.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. I literally just finished it. And what I love about it too is the poster art is also just as iconic as the first one. They understood the assignment. They knew what they were
doing. So good. Okay. We've already done an Argento idol worship as part of the Midnight Mass, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, what is your favorite directed Argento film? I mean, you're wearing an opera t-shirt. I can't assume, so I must ask.
I don't know if I can choose one. I think, you know, it obviously would have to be Suspiria, but following up very closely is opera, Inferno. I love Inferno. And Tenebrae, they're really all so good. Phenomena.
What's your favorite, Michael?
Oh, it changes. I'm with Andrew on this one. I do really love opera.
I was going to say, what if we take Suspiria out of the equation?
It's between Inferno and opera for me.
Oh my God, bitches. Just choose one.
It's probably opera for me. I do like Phenomena quite a bit. I mean, it's probably the one I've seen the most, oddly enough. Like, it was one of those movies that when Anchor Bay put out Phenomena on DVD, I would just throw it on all the time in the background. So it's sort of like always in a loop in my brain. But there's just something really fierce about opera. I think that all of the kills are crazy. You know, that whole like eye hole thing where the shoot through the eye hole is such a set piece.
What about the bird with the crystal plumage?
Bird with the crystal plumage is magnificent.
Am I tripping or is that getting a like remake?
Oh, maybe.
It might be. And of course, a lot of fans would say Deep Red.
Oh my gosh, Profondo Rosso.
Yeah.
Deep Red is having a moment right now. I get all of the ads for all of the horror t-shirt companies because of course I order them. So my algorithm sends them all to me. Suspiria for a long time was the trendiest of the trendy, but lately it's been Deep Red t-shirts, all different kinds of Deep Red t-shirt artwork coming out.
Well, because next year is Deep Red's 50th anniversary.
Ah,
so they're probably leading up into
sense.
That.
Gosh, isn't that crazy? But there's so many just like iconic things in Deep Red, like the baby doll, and that would make a great shirt.
Well, it's all just fabulous. And
it is.
We are like thrilled that you got to come on and talk about Demons, but also we knew, Michael and I knew with your interview, we were going to delve deeper into your love of horror and your love of Argento and all of this art. So maybe we should plan a Demon screening, the three of us at some point. We should look into that.
I would love that.
Usually when we wrap up episodes about a particular movie, I ask the guest this question regarding to the movie. But because this conversation has sort of evolved into a larger Italian horror Argento discussion because of the work that you've done, I'm going to ask you this. From your time discovering his films to doing Stereo Argento to now, how has your relationship with the work of Argento changed, if at all?
So my relationship with the work of Argento is always different upon revisiting it. There's so many factors in his work that I like, I'll kind of focus more in on when I revisit it. But it's mostly the Italianness of it all that I really, really enjoy. It's just so unique. I'm a huge fan of dubbing in film, and that's what I like so much about these films is just like the clear production that you can see in that. And I don't know if you saw Dark Glasses, but like, you know, even newer work is coming from Argento. It really is this just like master of his craft, completely in its own lane that I just respect so much. And it's so obvious how many people have pulled inspiration from his work. And it's just so melodramatic and fierce and in your face and opulent. And yeah, it's drag.
It's horror drag. Argento's like the original horror drag queen. Well, Meredith, we cannot thank you enough for coming on. We know that you could have been a guest on so many of the different episodes because your love of these films like ours is expansive. Where can folks keep up with you? Where can they see your fantastic films and stuff? Do you have them online?
My feature film that Michael mentioned up top, Alone, Not Alone, is no longer available online. It used to be, but that came out in 2015. Why don't I do a 10-year anniversary?
It is fabulous.
Drop of that?
Yes.
That's like a really funny piece that I kind of will watch every couple of years where I'm just like, wow, this is so art school, but like kind of.
It's
like,
good.
I don't know, some of this stuff.
It is really good. Yeah.
Don't call it art school. It's good.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I made that while I was really interested in Roman Polanski's Apartment trilogy. So like it was the first time that I ever found myself living alone. And that's like kind of so much about what the horrors in those films are about. So that's kind of how that came to be.
Well, we'll keep the listeners posted on your anniversary screening to be determined.
Do. But then another thing is recently I was going through old hard drives and I found the footage of one of our Stereo Argentos. It was, Michael, I think that you were in person for this one, Complex.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, that was amazing.
So I found footage that was taken of Complex, which was like probably the most PCP show that we did. It was like a live stage show. It was an original show that we wrote and produced called Complex, which was a, you know, giallo whodunit murder mystery about these people that are, you know, not unlike these demon films where people are trapped in an apartment building and there's a killer. I mean, kind of more black gloved giallo kind of killer, picking them off one by one, and, you know, drag numbers would happen in between. And I actually found that and I uploaded it to Vimeo. I don't know if like in the show notes you can link to it or something, but it's out there. It is so fun to watch. If you want to see the stud in like its prime before it closed, and, you know, thankfully it's reopening, but like that's such a good time capsule of like, if you want to check out what Stereo Argento was, if you just want to feel the vibe of that space, like that's a really fun thing to watch. And something I'm really proud of, honestly. Like, I really am proud of that.
Well, show. We will spread the good word when we release this episode. Make sure people have those links, especially our Patreon listeners, where we'll post the video there, if that's okay with you. Thank you, Andrew/Meredith. We love you.
Thank you.
And that was our interview with the fantastic Meredith, a.k.a. Andrew Sheets. I hope you listened to that interview in quadraphonic Stereo Argento sound.
Well, how else would you listen to it, really? Nowadays, any of us can live in an Argento world. I finally convinced my husband, Nihat, to let me replace all of the light bulbs. Well, not all of them, but most of the light bulbs in our tiny apartment, which includes 80s track lighting, which we never use because it's so hideous. But I've taken these light bulbs and put them in the track lighting and put them in the different lamps and things around the apartment. And they're the, you know, ones that you talk to Alexa. Oh, shit, I shouldn't say her name or she's going to get confused. But I sometimes can turn my entire apartment red and hot pink just because, you know, you can do that with these bulbs. So I would recommend all of you go out and turn your living space into an Argento-fueled hot pink nightmare.
Well, you did say in the interview with Meredith that Argento's movies are drag, and now your apartment is even more Argento, which makes sense.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, one thing I will say about Bava in this film is it leans into style. It leans into excess, but it's not Argento. You know, it is not, it is its own thing. And this is one of the movies when I was making All About Evil that I sat down and watched with my brilliant director of photography, the late Tom Richmond, who was so talented and so amazing. And I was so intimidated by Tom because he was this veteran who'd made so many incredible movies. And if you're a genre fan, the less successful movies he worked on, but the ones that I really love are things like Chopping Mall and House of a Thousand Corpses. And he really was a brilliant artist. But I showed him Demons. I showed him Phantom of the Paradise. There were just these few movies that we sat down and watched together. But Demons does not have the sort of Argento look that people might think it does. It has its own feel, its own style. Right. It's dark and golden. You know, it has this sort of luster that's its own thing. So again, Lamberto Bava was the mastermind behind Demons, who had the help of Dario Argento. And this film, I think, is that perfect mix of a group of artists who came together to make something, it's, you know, uniquely its own. Oh, I love Demons.
Me too. I think that Lamberto Bava brought elegant savagery to this movie. There's something really vicious about it, but it's still beautiful. It's a matter of the era it was made, but it also speaks to the level of skill of all parties. Just the practical artistry on display in this movie. Everything had to be made or built in some way, and sometimes it was complex, and sometimes it was really simple. One of my favorite lasting images of the film is that sequence where the demons are kind of approaching through the hall in silhouette, but their eyes are all shining. And that was just done utilizing reflective paper put on the eyelids of the actors. But that's super iconic, you know? And that, a simple effect, leaves a lasting impression, let alone the bigger effects. This is masters at work, firing on all cylinders. This is a grand example of great 80s horror.
Yeah, not to keep bringing back up All About Evil, but I think because my film All About Evil was so massively inspired by movies like Demons and Popcorn and things I'd seen in the 80s that were movies that took place in movie theaters, you literally will see sequences and shots, if you're a fan of both these movies, that are exactly the same. There's a sequence in Demons where the audience is trying to get out of the theater and they're banging on the doors. And I know I've brought up Heklina a lot in this episode for some reason, but there is a shot in All About Evil where Heklina is leading a charge of people and they're banging on the doors. Do you remember that in Demons?
I do.
It's not subtle. It's me loving Demons and just recreating the exact same moment in my own movie. This film has been massively influential. So much so, Michael, that I don't know if you even know this, but there was in the original script to All About Evil, there was an homage to Demons that was so specific to Demons that I actually took it out because it was too, you know, on the nose. You know what I mean? Like, it might have veered into ripoff versus homage, you know?
Right. And that's because you also couldn't have Natasha Lyonne ride a motorcycle through the Victoria, right? That's
No, it's because I second-guessed the sequence in All About Evil where a character, do you know what's weird? I don't even remember which character it was. I think it was Adrian, came tearing through the screen, the big movie screen, you know? And that, of course, was right out of Demons. And I pulled it because it was just kind of like, I knew I was just sort of stealing it. If you look at the audience banging on the doors scene in Demons and you look at All About Evil, you go, those are actually the same camera setups. But it's not the kind of thing someone goes, oh, they stole that. You know what I mean? Whereas right. Someone ripping through a movie screen, that would have been directly lifted.
It's the difference between artistic homage and theft.
Yeah, kind of. And as an artist, a lot of it just comes down to intention because Tarantino often just directly lifts from his favorite films and recreates those moments. But I don't think of it as theft. I do think of it as art.
Well, and we have a genre for that. It's called exploitation. And, yeah. And Tarantino, no matter how many millions he makes movies with, he's still an exploitation filmmaker because of the movies he makes. They are a loving exploitation of the movies that inspired him. And I think that we come from an era of video rental, grindhouse screening kind of horror that was informed by 50s era drive-in. The exploitation filmmakers of yesteryear borrowed from the 50s. We borrow from the exploitation filmmakers because that's what we grew up with. It's a cycle.
In fact, Demons probably inspired Tarantino. And this, I know we need to wrap up because you and I are in that mode now where we actually love doing this show so much that if Michael and I didn't actually restrain ourselves, these episodes would be 5 hours long because we just can talk all day about the movies we love. But I will say this, when All About Evil was in production, the movie Inglourious Basterds came out, which has a finale in a movie theater with a woman trapping an audience in a movie theater. Of course, I was completely freaked out because I had already created a script and was making a movie that had a similar finale. But if you look at that finale, some of the reasons it looks like All About Evil in some ways, I think is because we were both inspired by Demons, if that makes sense.
Makes sense to me.
Yes, listener, I am putting myself on the level of QT.
Right.
It's homophobia, girl. I mean, if I were straight and white, you know, I could have had a career like Quentin Tarantino.
Are you not white?
Oh, I guess I am. I forgot about that.
Well.
Yeah, anyway, whatever.
I do know what you mean. And I think that it's a conversation that is born out of our love of movies, more so our love of crazy movies like Demons. And as you said, we could sit and talk about a movie like this for hours because look at all the various places it takes us. And all of them come back to one film.
Until we get to the mini mass.
That's true.
Maybe two films. So if you want more, if you're going, hey, girls, don't wrap it up. I'm dying for more talk on Demons. Well, then head over to the Patreon because momentarily we'll be releasing a follow-up about Demons 2. But this film, to me, is about going to the movies. And if you, like us here at the Midnight Mass Podcast, want some real-life horror and a 4D experience when you head to the cinema where you might encounter demons and motorcycles in the auditorium, well, then you too may be one of the children of the popcorn now.
Ciao. Midnight Mass is created and co-hosted by Peaches Christ and Michael Verratti. The series is produced by Joshua Grinnell, Michael Verratti, and Heather Dunham. The Midnight Mass score and theme music was composed by Andrew J. Sepperly. Midnight Mass is a Peaches Christ production.